Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Utah native Elizabeth Hyder, author of a new crime thriller, May the Wolf Die. It's getting great reviews. Here's a taste of the plot. Nikki Serafino is enjoying the sunset from her boat in her beloved port city of Naples, Italy, when she discovers the body of a man in the warm waters of the bay. An investigator working as a liaison between local police and American troops, Nikki is certainly no stranger to violence and organized crime, but this case grows complicated when the victim turns out to be a U.S. Navy captain stationed at the nearby military base. The autopsy reveals foul play. As she delves into the case, another body is found, and Nikki must face connections linking the murders to her own complicated history as a daughter of Naples. Elizabeth Hyder lived in Italy for several years, working as a research analyst for the U.S. Navy. She also worked as a scientist at the European Space Agency and for Microsoft's AI for Science research program. Her short fiction has earned recognition from the Santa Fe Writers Writer Awards, New Century Writer Awards. Made the Wolf Die is a New York Times Best Crime Novel of 2024, Washington Post Best Mystery of 2024, and a Publishers Weekly Best Book of 2024. And Elizabeth Hyder joins us from her home in The Hague in the Netherlands. Elizabeth Hyder, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Tom. I'm really happy to be here.
So the Hague, it's about, you were telling me 5 p.m. there, the 5 o'clock
hour. It is 5 p.m. Yeah. And it's very dark outside.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. You're far north there. We forget that. Northern Europe is dark, quite far north.
Yeah, dark days of winter, man. They're rough, you know?
Yeah. So we were just barely, we had a nice conversation before we went out there. Probably should have hit record then, but we're talking about high school reunions. You were just back in Utah recently for a book tour with this this book and for your high school reunion. And I was telling you that I had not been to a high school reunion. Early years, I didn't feel like I'd accomplished enough. And so then you were saying, well, that isn't the metric we should be using.
Yeah, that really struck me when I was at, I went to this high school reunion and I hadn't seen a lot of these people, for a long time. I mean, some friends I hadn't seen since high school, you know, so it's been 30 years, you know. Some of them I did keep in touch with, like one of my dearest friends, Stacey Jensen, is actually a local actress in Salt Lake City, and she and I have been just besties for, you know, entire lives. But some people I just hadn't reconnected with, and I got to see them. And yeah, and it really did strike me because, you know, some of the conversations that I had with people at the reunion, you know, people did focus on like, okay, what's the accomplishment? But the thing that I started noticing is that, like, you know, you don't get to this part in life without having experienced a lot of depth, right? We, you know, people get to this stage and you've suffered a lot. And it seems to me like there is, you know, it carves out this depth of character and this meaning in people. And that to me was much more significant metric. You know, I think that we can kind of get fixated on like, what did we acquire? What did we do? Did we check the boxes? Did we have the things, you know? And sort of from our own perspectives, like we judge ourselves by all of the things that we did not accomplish, right? We sort of see the negative space. And then we look at everybody else's lives and we only see the highlights. And so we kind of have this unjust comparison that we perform on ourselves and on others. And I think that, you know, at a certain point, like it isn't the things that you've done. It's sort of, you know, how did you manage with the disappointments? How did you keep persevering even when things went badly? You know, and so that really struck me when I was at the reunion and I saw some of the really beautiful people. And what they'd accomplished kind of on a deeply psychological and emotional and spiritual level that was quite apart from any like box checkery. So that was my takeaway from that experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, you're matured along, unlike me when I was thinking about the, you know, my reunions. But I could imagine you, and I'm sure you didn't do this, you know, walking in and humble bragging. Hey, what did you get up to, Elizabeth? Well, I was a civilian analyst for the Navy. I work for the European Space Agency. I have a well-reviewed book coming out now, that kind of thing.
Oh, well, you know, I think, like I said, like, I don't know that I saw that. I think what I did was I got in touch with the person I had been, you know, when I was in high school. I was like, you know, and sort of you sort of reconnect with that particular version of yourself. And I think you, and I do think we sort of see the missing pieces in ourselves, you know. I think, and so it can feel, I don't know, like I don't know that those metrics of the things that we've, you know, we've achieved are the real deal, you know. I don't know. I just don't feel that anymore. I lost a good friend of mine earlier this year, and it just kind of readjusted my priorities, you know. And maybe it's just because, like, I mean, I'm in my 40s, you know, and so the things that I, you know, when you go to your high school reunion in your 40s, it's like, it's not like any of us are really bright and shiny anymore. You know what I mean? Like, we've, you know, I think when you go to your high school reunion, when you're like, you know, 5, 10, 15 year reunion, you have like a view to like, I'm going to do these things, and this is the important person that I am. But I think that you kind of circle back around, you know, at, you know, little mature ages, and just realize like, no, that's, you know, the important thing is just the relationships. So yeah, that's kind of my takeaway from that experience. But thank you for, I'm happy to have you brag on me. That makes me feel really good.
Yeah, I guess that's the more appropriate, have others brag on you. I want to read a bit from a blog post. This is quite recent. You have a blog you can find on your website, elizabethhyder.com. I'll just read a bit from this. You say, over the past 2 decades, writing has evolved into a way to investigate and understand the emotional truths of my life. I'd love to tell you that this process is calm, patient, and grounded in a willingness to sit with discomfort. That description is too sterile and far different from the messy reality. For me, writing has often been an act of desperation, a rough tool I used to claw through an emotional landscape I didn't understand, one that I urgently wanted to escape. As I reflected on this, you write, I realized that being in touch with my own difficult emotions allows me to connect more authentically with my characters. Suffering is something we all experience. When I can make space for it in my writing, when I can be present with my own difficult experiences, I have compassion for my characters. And then you go on to close that. That struck me. And there's a difference, you say, in your nonfiction writing and your fiction writing. It sounds like fiction is a way for you to, I guess, you know, come to terms with truth. And I guess I'll just ask you, what does fiction writing do for you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, so I mean, you mentioned I'm a scientist and a research analyst, right? And so I've written scientifically my whole life, and it, you know, you what you're trying to do is be like merciless and pure in sort of defining the facts and the numbers, right? And you're, you know, but I don't really feel, after all these years of doing that kind of writing, that that really gets at the heart of what like our experiences actually are. You know, I just was corresponding with a European Space Agency astronaut, Thomas Pesquet, who he and I had written a report that we ended up publishing a couple of years ago about his mission. And you know, what we'd done is I'd just gone back and I'd interviewed and researched all of the scientists who had payloads that went up with him on the space station, and to try to understand and, you know, like quantify like what was the impact of his research on the station. And so we wrote this really huge report that then we condensed into a journal article that talked about, like, you know, he did this particular payload experiment and it taught us about the human brain in the following ways, and, you know, sort of trying to quantify and really capture that particular message. And I really thought, I thought about it and I was like, you know, yeah, that does give us a slice of what that experience was and why it was significant that he was on the space station. But it doesn't necessarily, you know, it's kind of like an MRI scan where you get just a single image, right? But it doesn't give the whole depth of what that experience is, because, you know, as a, you know, as a human up in orbit, like, you're gonna have like this depth of emotional reality and just the physical day-to-day living on the station, and the just like the psychological aspect of you, and you bring the spiritual and emotional side, and that depth of experience is itself just inherently meaningful as a human. And it is, it kind of, that depth is also important. And so, like, when you sort of reduce and prune back the experience to only be this one dimension of like, okay, well, we were able to perform this many experiments and we got these many data points, I mean, those are the kind of metrics you would use to assess the performance of a robot, right? But this is not a robot in space. This is a human being that's having this really deep emotional experience in space. And so, I mean, I think that's part of the reason, like, Samantha Harvey's book Orbital, that just won the Booker Prize, was like a very poetic description of what it was to be human and what it is to sort of be circling the Earth. And so I kind of feel that's been true of all of the academic reports that I've written, is that, you can tell a story in a very numerical, data-driven way, but that doesn't give you the full reality of the experience. And so for me, when I write fiction, it kind of allows me to go into that depth. And I don't know that I mean, I know that some people have been able to do this with nonfiction. Like, there are some really fabulous memoirs out there that people can really, give that depth and breadth of their own personal experience, that doesn't just describe facts, that describes, what the impact of those facts were, and what did that mean for them personally. And I'm not to that point yet. I think it's like, I don't have the ability to, I don't think that I could do that yet with nonfiction, but I can certainly do it with fiction. I can explore a character's, a full range of experiences, and as they, what does it mean for them to be in the world? And that allows me to sort of find out what my own emotional landscape is.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Elizabeth Heider. She's a Utah native, and has a new book out. It's a crime thriller set in Naples, Italy, and it's getting great reviews. Before we go to a break, I want to get a little a couple of points from your biography. Very, very fascinating. So understand that you had the, I guess, the interest in writing very early in your life. There was a creative writing class for adults. So there, I guess there in this class there are a bunch of adults, and then you, 8 years old. Tell me about
Yes,
this.
yes. Yeah, my sister Laura and I both attended, and my mom took us every Thursday night. The teacher was Lofton Harvey, who is an absolutely amazing teacher and a wonderful human. And he was an English teacher at Bingham High School in South Jordan, and he would teach this Thursday night class for these adults, and it was just a marvelous experience. And you would bring our stories, we'd read them out loud, we'd get feedback, and it was really an encouraging and nurturing experience for me. And it sort of taught me some of the basics of, like, how do you describe interactions between people, character development, character-driven story. So it was really a wonderful, wonderful time. And as a matter of fact, like, I mean, Lofton, when I was back in Salt Lake City, I visited him half a dozen times. He's still around. He's a wonderful, absolutely amazing teacher, best teacher in the world. So that was a great experience.
Have you kept any writings from 8 years old?
I wonder, I don't have them myself. I bet my parents do in the basement.
Right. Where all of our stuff is. Yeah, that's true. So I graduated high school early at 16, entered University of Utah's actor training program. So you performed Shakespeare, Chekhov, etc. Then decided to go to physics. What was that decision like?
Yeah, I was really compelled. I was very curious about things. I mean, I love theater. It was a great experience. And I just had the sense that there were mysteries that I wanted to explore and uncover, and things that people could teach me that I couldn't teach myself in physics. And so I really wanted to know how things worked. I wanted to understand the universe. And so I was really drawn to that. So I went and started studying physics at the University of Utah, and I had some really fabulous professors there. They're extremely kind to me. I mean, I was coming in as a physics student. I remember I was I didn't have a good sense that I could pull it off at the time. I think the reason I kind of got encouraged to do it is I watched a movie called IQ with Meg Ryan, where she plays like Einstein's niece. And I sort of had this revelation of, like, oh yeah, girls can do physics too. And so I got myself a Meg Ryan haircut and just went to Physics 101 and sat in the class, and would go knock on Professor Solomon's door and try to have him explain to me like what a graph was. So, but I was deeply drawn to physics, and I really enjoyed it and loved it. And so that's why I got, I did an undergraduate degree at the University of Utah, and then I went on to Tufts University in Boston and finished my PhD there.
That's interesting. IQ to me, I consumed it as a romantic comedy. But they just happened to have Einstein. So it was an empowering message for you.
Yeah, I think, it's funny because I know that there's a lot of discussion about representation in media. And it's funny, and I was looking back just to back at the type of representation that I had when I was younger, and some really fabulous, characters like Gillian Anderson and the X-Files, portraying like a they were portraying people that were not part of my social circle growing up. I hadn't seen women do those kinds of things. And so it was really important for me to have this idea that it was possible for me to do it too. I think, I just had a lot of gender messaging growing up and didn't understand that there were other options out there. So I'm actually very grateful for a lot of movies and television that showed me how, what was possible.
So you were a civilian in the with the military. One of the things you did was write war games. We
I did, yes.
think about war games. I never realized you would write them, but once I learned that, I thought, well, yeah, that's logical. Somebody has to write the scenario, right?
It was really, really fabulously fun stuff. I mean, the guys that I worked with, they still did a lot of wargaming, and we'd write like scenario development for like contingency response, like if something nasty got out, what would the impact be? How would you know? How would you respond to it? What'd you do? How do you share information between organizations? And so yeah, so you think about like, who's the bad guy? What are they doing? What are they up to? How are they doing it? And then how would you know? How would you find out? And so, yeah, no, that was some of the most interesting analysis, and it was great preparation for writing mysteries.
Tell me about Interact. You weren't in the military. You weren't sworn in, but you were a civilian working with them. What, I guess there's good and bad in any profession, any organization. Tell me a little about what you learned about the military.
Yeah, no, it was a really fascinating experience. It was kind of like you're just kind of balled up and thrown in the middle of the situation. So I did write war games, but I also deployed. So I was a civilian, thrown on a U.S. Navy. The first deployment I was on was an aircraft carrier, and it was doing an exercise. And oh, that was a crazy cool experience. I mean, we were just like our berthing was just below the flight deck, and the planes had slammed down, and it was crazy interesting. And I did that for a few weeks, and then the next deployment was this amphibious transport dock ship off the west coast of Africa for 3 months, and we just went down range. And some of the most remarkable people I've ever met were in the Navy, and as an institution, I just thought it was it's a really good institution, and the missions that I was participating in, just deep, deep respect for the military, deep respect for the Navy. And but like any organization, I mean, there are going to be, things that don't work. There are going to be broken pieces, and people who kind of get trapped in bad situations in a system, and that is something that I wanted to also explore in this book that I wrote.
Then to the European Space Agency, what did you do with them?
I was the interface between the science payloads that went on the International Space Station and operations. So we would, you have, I don't know how many people know this, but like, so the space station, it's always manned, and you have, basically these astronauts being scientists. They have, dozens of experiments that they are participating in and supporting. So they're the sort of tip of the spear for the scientists on the ground. It's this very symbiotic relationship. And my job, I was in the requirements planning team, and I was trying to make sure that like all the science requirements were met on the station, and help to make priority calls if, for example, like you were going to change the beta angle of the station and lose power for a little bit, which payloads would suffer least if you shut them off. And so this was basically a constant job. We would just do planning and operations over a continuous cycle for the entire time I was there. I worked in that position for about 8 years.
That sounds fascinating. I understand you wrote a comic series for them.
Yeah, and I was like, I used to watch the I watched would watch the payloads. I would be in a console room watching the crew members float around, and that was really interesting. And I you'd kind of you know, because I was accounting for things like, you know, how long does an activity take and whatnot, and you know, it's a really fun experience to sort of, you know, watch people, you know, orbiting the Earth doing their thing. And I kind of had this deranged idea that, you know, what if the perspective was not the perspective of the astronauts, but what if it was, what if you saw what was happening from the perspective of the experiments? And so I started chatting with a wonderful lady who was in charge of public affairs, and she said, oh yeah, we should do this. I had an idea of having a comic about this. And so we did it, you know, and they hired a wonderful artist, Ed Grace, who did all the illustrations for this, and we had a series of really funny. It was just a, it was a great fun.
Let's take a break now, and we'll come back and talk about the book, May the Wolf Die. It's out and available now, and it's getting great reviews. As it's planned as part of the first one in a series, so we'll get talking about that as well. We're talking with Elizabeth Heider. She's a Utah native, lived in Italy for several years, working as a research analyst for the U.S. Navy. Also worked as a scientist at the European Space Agency and for Microsoft's AI for Science research program. May the Wolf Die is a New York Times best crime novel, Washington Post best mystery, and Publishers Weekly best book. It's out and available, as I mentioned now. The website is elizabethheider.com. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Utah native Elizabeth Heider, author of the new crime thriller, May the Wolf Die. It's getting great reviews. It's out and available now. You can find Elizabeth Heider at elizabethheider.com. Elizabeth Heider lived in Italy for several years, working as a research analyst for the U.S. Navy, worked as a scientist at the U.S. European Space Agency, and for Microsoft, their AI for Science research program. Her short fiction has earned recognition from the Santa Fe Writers Award and New Century Writers Awards. And as I mentioned, May the Wolf Die is getting great reviews. So I want to have you talk about Naples, and we'll get into May the Wolf Die. But first of all, The Hague, where you're talking to me right from right now. I guess at this point, you're launching into books. You probably could live anywhere. The Hague does sound like a wonderful place. I just want to read this. You say, I live in The Hague, where I bicycle to work across the dunes, make wine from grapes in my garden, and skate on frozen canals. So, yeah, why wouldn't you live in The Hague?
No, I love living in the Netherlands. I've had a love affair with the Netherlands for a long time, so it's lovely to be here. But I also have friends down in Naples, and I do get back there as frequently as I can.
So tell me about Naples. You lived there for 3 years, and then you've been back, I guess, on visits. You described this. I was trying to find this where I was reading this. I couldn't find it, but from my faulty memory, you described it as a almost baroquely a beautiful place, too beautiful, but it kind of seeps into your mind. But it's also a violent place.
It is a violent place. You know, it was such a shocking place when I first arrived. If you've never been there, it's just rich with history. It's layered with this, you know, the Flavian Amphitheater was right next door to where I lived, and the Rione Terra and the sunken city of Baia. I mean, these ancient Roman, you know, cities, you know, and they're everywhere. You know, you just stumble across archaeological finds everywhere. This Pompeii down the road, but also just like the scenery is just stunning. I mean, the Bay of Naples is this gorgeous blue, and you know, the islands of Capri and Ischia on the distance. And I was stationed there from 2010 to 2013. I was yeah as a research analyst with the Navy, and it was oh it just bled into me. I absolutely loved it. And the culture is so rich and vibrant. It's a wonderful, wonderful place to be. But sort of layered on top of like this, you know, this beautiful historical vistas and everything, you do have this crime that's very baked in. The organized crime of it's called the Camorra, which is just a system of a bunch of different organized criminals. I mean, they've been in the system as a shadow government since the 1700s, and they really do, you know, they're visible. You can see little indications of it. As an American living there, I wasn't confronted with it on a daily basis, but people who live there really are. I think we're sort of shielded a little bit as Americans living there. But the journalist Roberto Saviano writes about it a lot. And it's he wrote a book called Gomorrah, which was just an absolutely powerful and horrifying book about the organized crime in Naples and the surrounding areas. And then he's subsequently written several other books about it. And there are some television series about it too. So it's sort of this juxtaposition of this profound beauty and of course this big darkness as well.
So tell me how May the Wolf Die started. Where did this you probably had a maybe a kernel of an idea, but tell me how this started.
Actually, so the character of Nikki Serafino is inspired by this real life woman who is just this tough, fierce, amazing human I met back in 2010 when I was living there, and we've stayed friends ever since. And she is this she taught me Krav Maga, she trained me, and she's a security expert. And so the organization that she works for is analogous to this organization I call Phoenix Seven in the book, which is as a security liaison between the local law enforcement and any military personnel. So if you got involved in a traffic accident or a home invasion or something like this, anything involving the local law enforcement, then you would have Phoenix Seven come and enter and be a liaison for that, which is extremely great for the U.S. military personnel that are stationed down there. And anyway, so I was visiting her in 2021, and we were out on the Bay of Naples on her boat. She owns this wonderful sailboat, and she co-owns it with this police officer who does a lot of anti-corruption work. And as I was on the Bay of Naples, and you have Vesuvius in the background and this gorgeous city in the background, and I'm looking at the two of them, and I thought, how are you not characters in a murder mystery? And so this idea sort of percolated, and I floated it past them. I said, oh, what do you think about this? And very generously gave me a lot of their time and expertise, and I got a tour of the police station and the forensics unit, and they're extremely kind and helpful and generous in helping me research and trying to make this as authentic as possible. And so that was the origin of the characters themselves, of Nikki and Valerio. And the plot, it took me a little bit longer, so I couldn't start writing it until I'd figured out the plot. And as a, I really did not want to write a murder mystery where I didn't understand the murderer. So I was walking on the beach one night, and I started thinking, okay, what would it take for me to be willing to kill somebody? And that was the origin of this particular plot for this book.
Yeah, that's interesting. If you're going to have a murder mystery, you need to obviously you have to have a murderer. As a writer, you need to be able to get in their head, I guess, right? And
Yeah, I mean,
have
I
some
want to,
empathy.
yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think you have to empathize, right? Because from whatever perspective it is, it's like, and I think it makes it, I think that makes writing murders kind of challenging, right? Because you don't really want to spend too much time in that place. It's a really dark place. But I think you have to understand it to a certain extent in order to be able to write about it effectively. And so yeah, I did a lot of reading, and I did a lot of I did a lot of research into that before I wrote it. But yeah, that was the origin of that. And of course, the city itself is just such a rich and wonderful place to write about as well.
So tell me about Nikki. There's a whole very interesting backstory here with that you created for Nikki.
So Nikki is her mother is American and her father is Italian, and he was in the Carabinieri, which is basically the Italian military police, and her mother was a cryptological interpreter, which is basically a linguist for the U.S. Navy. And so she was stationed in Naples in the 1970s, and that's where the two of them met. And so Nikki kind of she bridges those two worlds naturally. So she's got the American side and also the Italian side. And so it's as like anybody, I think, who has like a mixed background like that, she's understands both worlds, but she doesn't really fully inhabit either of them. And so she She has had like a lot of personal tragedy in her life with her family. That's very complicated history, and she's very much been touched by a lot of the camorra, by the system, the organized crime in Naples. And so this is what makes her ideal to be able to sniff out what's going on and to see the signs in ways that other people maybe can't.
You've said that Nikki has spent her life bridging the gray space between cultures. What gray space? I guess she doesn't fully inhabit either culture. That's interesting phrase, gray space between the cultures.
So that I kind of really do feel like that's the case. And I've friends who, I mean, of course, as an American living in Naples, I'm never going to be a Neapolitan. I can see and appreciate, but I can't really embed fully into those systems, right? And then there's just this liminal space between the different cultures that it gets tricky to navigate that as a as an American. Like, so for example, I mean, when I go down and I'm going into some of these for research purposes, want to go into some neighborhoods that are very difficult in Naples. It would not be safe for me to go there by myself. But with this security expert who understands the signals, can see when things are, I'm not going to understand or recognize them. I can't read the tea leaves, about what is dangerous and what's not dangerous, because I don't live and breathe that culture. But I would need somebody who can navigate those very subtle cues, that gray space.
Do you have a passage you could read to us from the
Sure,
book?
sure. So this is in chapter one, and Nikki and Valerio are on their boat that they've restored, 1978 Balanzone. And Nikki goes off for a final swim before she's going to go back to work. The depth of this feeling was more profound than what she felt for most people. And why not? No other friend or lover had ever bestowed the gifts that Calypso offered. She was freedom, the knowledge that if life became too dull or unbearable, you could always escape into adventure. She was also wealth. How many of those rich people in their extravagant cliffside villas were looking out at the sea and envying her at this very moment? Inspired by the thought, Nikki looked back at Naples and smiled. From the sea, the city looked like a wedding cake, if the baker was both drunk and enthusiastic. So many chaotic layers, colorfully and haphazardly balanced, interspersed with palm trees and pines, bushes filled with bright flowers.
Yeah, beautiful.
Thank you.
Let's talk about maybe some themes in the book. What maybe start with the title, "May the Wolf Die." What's the wolf here?
Yeah, so May the Wolf Die is part of an Italian idiom. So if I were to wish you good luck for something, I would say in bocca al lupo, which means literally in the mouth of the wolf. And there's a lot of contention about what that comes from. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? It's kind of like saying break a leg before a performance. And you would respond to me, crepi al lupo, which means and may the wolf die. And so the origin is this Italian idiom, but of course it takes on a much more sinister meaning in this particular context. So the system that we're talking about, the organized crime, the corruption that happens, these broken institutions, they are run by wolves. And so the only way for people to be safe in that particular environment is for the wolf to die. And the book is really about these adaptations that people make in order to survive broken systems.
Tell me about a couple of the other characters, Valerio.
Yeah, Valerio is he's part of a anti-corruption unit that is some plainclothes police officers in the Naples police. And he is, he co-owns the boat with Nikki. So that's how they know each other. They're not romantically involved, they're just friends. And they're very clear about that. They've just made this conscious decision to put the friendship first and not let anything interfere with that. And so the story alternates between Nikki's perspective and Valerio's perspective as they are investigating this crime. So at the very beginning of the book, they in their boat, it's not too much of a spoiler, but they run into a body in the water, and it turns out that the body is tied to this naval, this is the U.S. Navy base, and so the position of the, you know, the situation requires that both of them are actually involved in the investigation. And so the story involves both of them and their lives, their personal lives. It was very important to me when I wrote this that, you know, one of the things that's kind of a pet peeve of mine is when I read a book and the characters just are only about the job, right? It's like this very, it's like they don't think about things like finances. They're not worried about their families. And maybe it sort of touches briefly on their interpersonal relations, but to, you know, to any of us that are living our real lives, you know, like the job is only one aspect of who we are. And in fact, like our ability to do the work is kind of arises from the depth of experience that we have as humans, you know? And so I really wanted to make sure that their lives were really, really fleshed out, and that it's the context of their lives is also the background of how they're doing this. They're connecting this murder investigation.
By the way, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, you're asking for more characters. I'm happy to talk about them in a second, but go ahead and we'll come back to that later.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I was just going to ask about, influences, murder mysteries, crime thrillers that you like and that you've read.
Absolutely. No, I love, John Le Carre, one of my absolute favorite authors, adore his work. I really regret that I didn't, you know, have the courage to just go across the channel and go have a conversation with him before he passed away, because his work is just outstanding. I mean, you know, I fell in love with George Smiley, who's one of the very best characters in literature, I think. So Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Smiley's People. Huge fan of the Cormoran Strike series by Robert Galbraith. Just always, you know, getting that as soon as that just comes off the off the press. Stieg Larsson, who is a wonderful, wonderful. His books, people know this is like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and the subsequent two books. Unfortunately, he also passed away before he could write more than those first three books, but just remarkable crime fiction, just really gorgeous stuff. I have a ton of other favorite authors as well in other fields, but I would have to say that those are some really influential ones for me. There are some nonfiction pieces that I love as well that, for example, there was a book that came out a couple of years ago called A Woman of No Importance by Sonia Purnell. And it's about Virginia Hall, who's a real life spy who was an American who went into France during the Second World War, and the information that she was able to get, she ran these networks that got, you know, people out of, prison and got downed airmen out of the country. And, she got the information that the Allies needed to be able to go into Paris. So it's, some really remarkable real world people to be influenced by as well.
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but several of the authors you mentioned, you also mentioned the movies that have been made from their books. Any hopes there for your
you
books?
Mean for this one?
For this one,
yes.
Yeah, but the
there
series
is
maybe.
Much I cannot say and wish I could. So the good news is I can share that that May the Wolf Die has been optioned for film and television.
All right.
That there is a production company that's currently working with that. I can't disclose more than that. I'm bound by an NDA, but I'm very excited by this prospect. I think it'll just be wonderful television series. I actually have this, like, I'm just going to put it out into the universe. Like, my fantasy is that one day I will be able to be on this boat in the Bay of Naples and be able to be there with my friend Sarah and her friend who co-owns the boat, and then Nikki and Valerio actors. Like, I just, this is like a fantasy I have. It's going to happen. That's my dream, is to actually watch it go down.
Let's put it out there. Getting ahead of ourselves, but not, you know, and authors usually don't have that much input in this, but who should play Nikki and Valerio?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I think it definitely Italian, preferably Neapolitan actors to play them. And I don't know anybody that would, you know, I think that it's going to be really fun when they actually do a casting call for this. I think we're going to find Nikki and Valerio. I think they're out there. We have to discover them. So that's going to be really fun to uncover who they are. I have some idea for castings for the other characters, but mostly because, you know, they're and I don't know the Italian acting community well enough to be able to peg somebody in particular for this, but there have been some really fabulous television series that are based in Italy that I think are, you know, it's clear that there's a lot of talent there, like the Elena Ferrante books, the Neapolitan books, My Brilliant Friend, for example. I mean, that was cast beautifully, as was Gomorrah and 000. So there's clearly a really talented community we're going to get to discover.
And hopefully an appetite for this. So yeah, hope that works out for you.
Yes.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the last segment with Elizabeth Heider. You can find her at elizabethheider.com. And we're talking about her debut novel, a crime thriller called May the Wolf Die. It's getting great reviews. She's planning a series with the lead character, Nikki Serafino. And we'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest is Utah native Elizabeth Heider, author of the new crime thriller, May the Wolf Die. It has been named a New York Times Best Crime Novel of 2024, a Washington Post Best Mystery of 2024, and a Publishers Weekly Best Book of 2024. Here's the plot in brief. Nikki Serafino is enjoying the sunset from her boat in her beloved port city of Naples, Italy, when she discovers the body of a man in warm waters of the bay. An investigator working as a liaison between local police and American troops, Nikki is certainly no stranger to violence and organized crime, but this case grows complicated when the victim turns out to be a U.S. Navy captain stationed at a nearby base, and the autopsy reveals foul play. So, Elizabeth Heider, tell me about a couple more of the characters here.
So one of the other main characters that I really love in this book is Durant Cole. He's an NCIS agent. The nice thing about having, there's a television series called NCIS, so I think that people are familiar with the role, which is basically a law enforcement role within the U.S. military. And so Durant is a really fascinating and dynamic character that I really enjoy working with. Sonia Jiang is a police officer. She's a murder investigator in the Naples police. She's Senegalese originally, so her family is from Senegal. So she encounters quite a lot of difficulty with a little bit of racism and some sexism as well. And she's very tough-minded and able to really be a professional and earn respect by being so professional. So she's a really interesting character as well. Nikki's boyfriend Enzo is owns a as a owns a club, a nightclub in Naples called Incendio. And they originally met, Nikki met Enzo years before because she had worked as a bouncer for the club. And so there's the development of that particular relationship as well. And then we also are introduced to Tito, who was Nikki's childhood sweetheart. They had dated all through their teenage years. And he is now he works for, he's a Camorra capo. He's a crime boss. So those are some of the main players in this game.
Tell me a bit more about the research for this book. It must have been fascinating. You lived in Naples, obviously, but you needed to, you know, you didn't know all of these worlds. So tell me about the research.
As I mentioned, so I did live in Naples, and so there is that aspect of just being present and knowing the area. I also, of course, there's the other world that it inhabits as well, which is the U.S. military world, and I fortunately had some original research in that. I worked with the U.S. military in a variety of capacities for about 8 years, and really came to sort of see, you know, what it was to work in that institution, you know, how, you know, the procedures, the rank, you know, what it is to be on a U.S. Navy ship. And those experiences really inform a lot of this book as well. And then, of course, I had some original, so I had some people to consult with me in terms of the Naples law enforcement side. So there was a police officer who agreed to, you know, give me some, you know, background research, and of course my friend Sarah, who works as a liaison, who was very kind to answer a host of questions from me. I mean, I'd be writing and I would want to know answers to questions like, so when you go to work, do you work on shifts? Do you wear a uniform? Do you not wear a uniform? Do you have a partner? Do you call each other by your first or your last names? I mean, just those little details that are really important to understand, how a particular system works. And this lovely police officer took us, through the Naples police headquarters and, took us up through the perpetrator elevator. We got to, we walked around. He showed us how things worked. How would you book a suspect? Took us in, introduced us to the other folks on his team and, let me handle their weapons and their handcuffs and understand how that worked. Across the street from the police station is the forensics laboratory, the Polizia Scientifica, and we were able to take a tour of that, watch a suspect actually get, booked into the system, picture taken, fingerprints, et cetera. Go up and talk to the guy that's in charge of the forensics laboratory. So it was a really wonderful like way of being able to write authentically about this. And then, the Naples culture, just being friends with people in Naples and seeing how, business was done. It's just a really a warmth and a depth to a lot of those interactions. And I was fortunate enough to be able to have people give, feedback on, did I get this correct? I it was very important to me that it was very authentic. And so when I was conducting edits for the book, I traveled back to Naples and sat in the locations oftentimes that I was writing about so that I could make sure that the descriptions really felt true to the actual environment. So I'm very fortunate that I still have, that I have so many people in Naples that I know and that are willing to tolerate me and host me in this. And yeah, and I and honestly, like my big ally in this was Sarah, who was just absolutely fantastic at, vetting this and making sure that there were no wrong notes.
So you've now planned I guess a 7-book series. That must be quite the process, plotting out 7 books. Do you have the entire thing plotted out?
Oh my gosh, it's so cool. Yes, it's really amazing. Yeah, it's a, you know, I love it when a story, where you have like a larger mystery to be solved, right? And so you can see that, you can see some of the clues for that in the first book, like if you are looking for it, so people can guess exactly kind of, what are the big pieces that we need to take away from the first book. And so then, it seeds through all of the rest of the series. And so I do have the major muscle movements plotted out for the 7 books. And so I know generally what's going to happen in each book and especially some of the major like what is the character journey through those 7 books? So both Nikki and Valeria are going to go through pretty significant journeys to be able to get to the point where they can do what they need to do in book 7, right? And so it's been fabulous to plot that out. I've had to do a ton of research about I don't want to do any giveaways here. I will kind of give a clue though. One of the books that I've really been doing a lot of research into is there was a book called The Sword and the Shield, which is Vasily Matrokhin was an archivist for the KGB, and he collected a ton of documents and handwritten notes over his 20-year career and kept them under the floorboards of his house. And after the Cold War ended, he tried to give those to the CIA and they didn't believe him. And so he went to the British Secret Service instead. And so this book is basically a collaboration between Christopher Andrew, who is a scholar, and Vasily Matrokhin. And it's I think it's like there's a 3-book series. I've only made it through book 1, but that's one that I've really been researching because I want to make sure that as I do this huge plot arc, I can get there. I've also been interviewing. There's some people that I know. I did some work for Interpol a few years ago, and so I have some contacts in the police, and they're sort of helping me understand. I need to understand organized crime, and I'm not particularly keen to get somebody who's like got firsthand experience of it from the inside. So I'm going through the policing route. to try to find that out and try to make sure that I understand counterterrorism and policing as well. So I'm making sure that the whole 7-book series is extremely well plotted out. And so this is where the analyst in me meets the fiction writer, because I want it to be really a well fleshed out, well thought out series. So I've written the second book, and that's in the hands of my editor right now. She's supposed to give me the changes, the edits, before Christmas. So I'm nervously waiting for that to come back in. And I've completely plotted out book 3, and I'm in the middle of writing that one. So that's where we're at in the whole process.
Well, we look forward to all those books. And of course, encourage people to pick up May the Wolf Die, the first book in the series. That's out now. And we've been talking with Utah native Elizabeth Hyder, author of this book. Well-reviewed. And Elizabeth Hyder lived in Italy for several years. She's worked as research analyst for the U.S. Navy, also worked as a scientist at the European Space Agency for Microsoft's AI for Science research program. And she's joined us from The Hague in the Netherlands. You can find her at ElizabethHyder.com. Elizabeth Hyder, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Tom. This has been wonderful.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.